Billy.
Morning. May it please the Court. On behalf of Appellant Paul Davis Restoration, this appeal arises from an order denying, or excuse me, this appeal arises from an order vacating an arbitration award that was entered pursuant to an arbitration clause in a franchise agreement. The issue before the Court relates to the application of the direct benefits estoppel doctrine, which is a doctrine that the Seventh Circuit, the U.S. Supreme Court, and other courts have recognized exists as a way to bind a non-signatory to an agreement to that agreement where they have knowingly exploited or availed themselves of the benefit of the contract. So it's essentially a common sense, equitable, and fairness principle that if you take advantage of all of the benefits of a contract, you can't then disavow all of the obligations and burdens. As this court said back in 1981...
Isn't there a rather straightforward contracts theory available here? The underlying contract says that anybody who takes these shares needs the approval of a franchisor and must consent to the contract, which includes the arbitration clause.
Correct, Your Honor.
Your client took the shares. Well, sounds like it comes with the terms of the contract.
Your Honor, I would agree that that the appellee here took the shares. Renee Everett secretly, without getting approval and consent from my client, the franchisor.
I'm sorry, Ed. Got that backwards.
But you're exactly right, Your Honor.
So that my question remains, isn't there a straightforward contract argument here?
Your Honor, the arguments we could identify through what I think is fairly exhaustive research to bind somebody that did not sign were the non-signatory theory, the direct benefits estoppel theory, the assumption theory, and that may be what Your Honor is closest to, the assumption doctrine. So essentially, by taking the shares...
I think you've got a problem with little cubby holes. Right? Maybe you're just not making this argument and you forfeited or waived it. But suppose there were a legend on the stock that says anybody who takes this stock is bound by the franchise contract. Then this would be perfectly straightforward. That's how many agreements are carried through legends. But of course, the function of a legend on the stock is to give notice of an underlying rule. It doesn't otherwise create the rule.
And Your Honor, the franchise agreement that is in the appendix, in fact, in Article 20, does require that the stock include that language. And we did not...
So maybe there is a legend on the stock. Do we know in this record whether there's a legend?
We do not have a copy in the record of the stock.
Why not?
It was not produced in discovery. We know what the franchise agreement requires, and it requires that any time you transfer the stock, you must consent and be obligated by the franchise agreement. But I think Your Honor is on exactly the right track, which is what makes this case so compelling as to why the district court erred in rejecting and applying far too narrowly a direct benefits estoppel theory, which is the primary argument we made along with assumption. And Your Honor is also right, and we cited these cases in the brief, including a Wisconsin case that says that you can bind somebody to a contract even if they haven't signed, if the circumstances warrant. So we would contend, for various reasons, that Ms. Renee Everett is bound by the terms of the franchise agreement, including the arbitration clause. This case is far more egregious and clear than any of the cases that we've relied upon as our primary authority. There are some seminal Second Circuit cases that we have relied upon, along with a Fifth Circuit Blaustein case. All of those cases do not have the facts as clearly set out as here, which are undisputed, which is Mrs. Everett wanted to have an ownership interest in the franchise when her husband became ill. That's the testimony, the undisputed record. In 2007 or 2008, her husband became concerned, Matt Everett became concerned, and he had signed the franchise agreement as the 100% principal owner. Under the franchise agreement, the franchise entity, the LLC, that the franchise agreement required that they form, this is not a company that's doing business, that's an LLC, that's a going concern and has lots of contracts out there. This is an LLC form pursuant to the terms of the franchise agreement, required by the terms of the franchise agreement, and it requires that not only the LLC sign the franchise agreement, but also requires that every principal owner, any owner of any share of the stock in the LLC, must also individually sign and be jointly and severally liable. And in fact, Mrs. Everett testified and Mr. Everett testified, and this is undisputed, that she decided in 2007 and 2008 when he became seriously ill that she needed to have an interest in the franchise. And so he transferred 50% of the ownership of the LLC to her at that time. For the express purpose, he was concerned with his health and they had a prenuptial agreement. The testimony is she actively intended to become an owner of the franchise. The franchise business here arises from solely from the franchise agreement. Everything springs from the franchise agreement. That is the source of the LLC that would not otherwise exist. That is the source of all the...
You mean they had no business at all before the franchise?
Correct, Your Honor. Mr. Everett testified...
I think they say otherwise.
Your Honor, the LLC was actually formed in June of 2004. The franchise agreement is dated September 1st. Mr. Everett's testimony, which is in...
Forming a particular LLC is different from having a business. My question is whether they had a business.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, you say no.
The LLC was formed for the express purpose of operating this franchise.
I just said having a particular LLC is different from having a business. The LLC is just a legal form through which a business is conducted. My question was whether there was an underlying business of any kind.
Not in this territory and not a Paul Davis franchise business. Mr. Everett owned several other Paul Davis franchises or was a sublicensee under several other franchise businesses at that time. But there was no legal entity operating a business, and there was no business in this territory.
So no, they did not operate. Was he terminated?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why was he terminated by the franchisor?
He had failed to pay royalties, Your Honor. And there had been a period of time where he had failed to pay royalties, and it was clear, our theory, and we think the evidence supports, that he had an exit strategy to get out of the franchise system, which involved what ultimately happened, which is he transferred the business, the remainder of the business, to his wife. She took down the Paul Davis sign after operating it as an undisclosed owner for 4 or 5 years and essentially put up a new name, which you see all the time in these sort of sham transactions. So he was terminated. Our position is he was terminated for cause. That issue was arbitrated separately. Matt Everett and EA Green Bay, the LLC, have been through an arbitration, and they lost. And that arbitration is the subject of current proceedings in Brown County Circuit Court in Wisconsin, where it's still ongoing. Efforts to confirm that arbitration award or to vacate it are ongoing.
You say that she operated for 4 or 5 years under the Paul Davis flag?
Well, depending on, at least she admits since 2008. It's undisputed, at least in 2008, there's a question because there's a members agreement that is dated 2004, which shows her from the outset as a 50% owner. They claim that was done when he became ill in 2007 and 2008 to give her an interest in the franchise from the beginning. So the facts are even more egregious here. So they intended that she would be deemed an owner of this franchise from the beginning, but never signed the franchise agreement. And so all of the cases that are relied upon by the appellee are distinguishable, and we respectfully submit that the district court erred fundamentally in finding the benefits derived from and flowing from this franchise agreement were indirect, when it is clear they could not be more direct.
I have a hard time seeing what the criterion of directness is in this context. I'm not sure these other cases demonstrate one side or the other very clearly.
Well, Your Honor, I think what they say is it has to be a benefit derived from the franchise agreement itself as to opposed to generally the business relationship. But here, what's unique about this case...
You don't have a business relationship without a franchise agreement.
Thank you, Your Honor. That's exactly our point. Everything springs and emanates here from the franchise agreement. That's the source, the genesis, the wellspring. Everything flows from that. And that's what she wanted an interest in. And that's why you couldn't have a more direct benefit. If you look at the Blaustein Fifth Circuit case... It's the same thing. Somebody formed an LLC to get legal advice for their new patent inventions, and then the individual members of the LLC also wanted legal advice. And the court said, look, you formed that LLC for the purpose of getting legal advice. You individual members are now exploiting that purpose. You too are bound. Here, as the court has noted, it's even more egregious because she was already obligated under the franchise agreement to have executed it individually and personally and jointly and severally because she obtained an ownership interest, which is mandated in the franchise agreement to require you to sign.
If she had not been an owner of EAGB, let's just take that off the board, but everything else factually would have been the same, would you still be making the same arguments you make this morning?
There are various theories we would be making, but they wouldn't be nearly as strong. So there are still theories where you can bind a non-signatory. A classic example is in the non-compete context where the husband has the non-compete and then gets terminated and transfers the whole business to his wife. That's sort of in the binding under a non-compete scenario as opposed to an arbitration clause. So there are certainly equitable doctrines and estoppel doctrines that would preclude that conduct as well. What makes this one particularly egregious is that everything here flowed from the franchise agreement. She became an owner for the purpose of deriving the benefits that all flowed from the franchise agreement. And to add to that, she was obligated upon the transfer of the ownership to individually sign the franchise agreement. So our perspective is, Your Honor, you couldn't get a more clear example of a case when these doctrines apply to bind a non-signatory. Under whatever theory of equity or contract law, she absolutely received all of the benefits under the contract, acted as was an owner of the contract, and was obligated to sign the contract. And so we think, respectfully, that the district court just got it wrong. He thought that benefits were too indirect, and that she just derived benefit from the relationship with the business generally.
Right. The ownership.
Right, Your Honor. And I just think that could not be, and we've cited in detail in our briefs the cases, the Blaustein case, the American Bureau of Shipping Second Circuit case, which this court cited both in its 2002 Frenetics decision and its 2005 Zurich decision on direct benefits estoppel, cited that. And that was a similar situation where a person getting a yacht built contracted with a contractor to build the yacht. The yacht contractor then separately contracted with a classification society that was needed to flag the ship so you could sail it. And there, the Second Circuit clearly found, look, it would have been impossible. You wouldn't have had a ship that you could sail but for the benefits derived under that contract between the builder and the ship classification agency. Blaustein is very similar. We've discussed that. There are numerous cases that we think are squarely on point. The Deloitte case, another case similar to this one, an individual member of a company was using the Deloitte name as part of an organization, marketing themselves as Deloitte. The Second Circuit said, hey, you can't claim you don't get benefits under the agreement and you're not bound when, in fact, you're marketing yourself as a Deloitte entity. Here, from 2008 at least on, there's a Paul Davis banner out there. She's operating a franchise, a licensed franchise, deriving all of the benefits. Then once the franchise is terminated, she gets the rest of the ownership, tears down the Paul Davis sign, and puts up the building work sign, using the same LLC, same employees. There's a smoking gun email in the record where she says, same great service, same great people, same great owner, under a new name. Just took it down, put up a new name, and continued operating. And is claiming that she's not bound now or has no obligations under the franchise agreement, that she just gets away, can just do whatever she wants. And we think, Your Honor, all of you, that the equitable theories here are overwhelming. The evidence here is overwhelming. This is an extremely clear case where direct benefits estoppel assumption apply to bind Ms. Everett, and that the district court erred here. And district court also, we believe, erred by imposing an additional requirement on the direct benefits estoppel doctrine by suggesting that you have to be suing on the agreement itself for the doctrine to apply. We think that is clearly not correct. There are many cases where that is the basis, where you sue on a contract and then try to avoid arbitration under it. But there are myriad cases that we've cited, including the Blaustein case out of the Fifth Circuit, which says that is only one way to embrace the benefits under a contract. As this court has said since 1981, if you knowingly avail yourself and exploit the benefits of an agreement, you can't shirk the responsibilities of the obligations. And that is exactly what Ms. Everett did here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Paul Davis wants to bind Renee Everett to a franchise agreement with an arbitration clause that she never signed. Its theory throughout this case for doing so has been direct benefits estoppel. But Paul Davis has never identified any direct benefit that Renee Everett received under the franchise agreement.
Before we get to the question whether it is even possible to separate the franchise agreement from the business, I'd like you to address the question that I asked Mr. Billig, which is, isn't this a straightforward contract case? The franchise agreement says the shares in the franchise can't be transferred without the franchisor's consent and without agreeing to this franchise agreement, which has the arbitration clause. Your client shows up with the shares. Isn't that quite sufficient to bind your client to the agreement?
I think the distinction there is who is a party to this contract. I certainly don't dispute that the franchise agreement had a clause requiring the franchisor's consent for transfer. I would
and
have a hard
requiring the new owner of the shares to agree to the franchise agreement.
And I would have a hard time arguing that Matt Everett, by transferring shares without Paul Davis' consent, didn't breach that provision of the contract. But, of course, Renee Everett was never a party.
The question I'm asking is whether it's a matter of simple contract law. The agreement does not pass with the shares. As I said to Mr. Billig, that would be plain if there were a legend on the shares. Mr. Billig responded that there was supposed to be a legend on the shares. Do we know that, whether it was there?
I don't believe there ever were any physical shares. If there were, I don't believe they're in the record, Your Honor. This is an LLC, a two-member LLC.
It's certainly perfectly normal in corporate law where there are shares that a legend is used to make agreements, whether they're non-transferability agreements, buy-sell clauses in closely held corporations, to make them run with the shares. And the new buyer of the shares can't say, well, I never signed that buy-sell agreement, so it doesn't apply to me. It just runs with the stock. The question I'm asking is whether this franchise agreement doesn't equally run with the stock.
And I think there where you have a more formal corporate entity with shares of stock, the argument would be as to why that would apply, either that the new shareholder had actual notice of the conditions of share ownership.
There doesn't seem to be any doubt that your client had actual knowledge. She was involved in running this business.
I don't know that she had any actual knowledge of the terms of the franchise agreement, though, Your Honor. She had knowledge of it.
I think the phrase willful blindness would apply. But I'm still trying to figure out why this isn't a straightforward contract case on the ground that there was an ownership interest and the obligations of the franchise agreement run with the ownership interest. You can't transfer one without transferring the other. That it would be just like a buy-sell agreement in a closely held corporation. You can't get out of the buy-sell agreement by transferring the shares in violation of the buy-sell agreement.
And I think here that perhaps it would have been a bit better theory for the appellant to have raised in front of the district court, but instead they decided to argue the case on the theory of direct benefits estoppel, which is an equitable theory, and that's the basis on which the district court made its decision and the basis
now
on
that,
benefit.
That's what puzzles me about this case. What was the flash of genius that came to Judge Griesbach to reverse himself on this point? Right in the middle of the case.
Well, I think the consideration was that he wasn't able to identify any direct benefit that Renee Everett received. Earlier on, he sort of decided the case almost on a fraudulent transfer theory, which wasn't really the theory that was argued at the preliminary injunction hearing. And I think he went back after reading the briefs on the confirmation and vacation proceedings and looked at the direct benefits estoppel doctrine and concluded it really didn't apply here because there was no direct benefit to Renee Everett.
I mean, it's a very unusual case in that regard, it seems to me.
Also, it's, of course, important to remember, Your Honor, that the burdens were different on the preliminary injunction hearing. There, Renee Everett had the burden of showing that the clearly established facts did not impose an obligation to arbitrate on her. He held that she had not met that rather high standard.
Well, Mr. Everett was running the business originally, right?
He was. He is no longer.
Yeah, and at a certain point, she took over, and then she ran the business. So how do you distinguish the two? Just on a question of a signature and a piece of paper?
Of course, the business, Your Honor, was operated through an LLC, and as the court found, the LLC continued to operate both before and after the transfer.
Yeah, but there wouldn't have been an LLC without an agreement. I think that's the point Judge Easterbrook was making.
Of course, the LLC could have been formed and was formed prior to the execution of the franchise agreement under Wisconsin law. There may have been obligations imposed on the LLC by the franchise agreement, and there certainly was an arbitration involving EA Green Bay LLC where an award was entered against it, and there are separate proceedings, as Mr. Billick indicated, regarding EA Green Bay LLC. So it isn't as if Paul Davis has no remedy against EA Green Bay LLC for anything it did either before or after the transfer of the shares from Mr. Everett to Ms. Everett. But Ms. Everett is a separate person from EA Green Bay LLC, and the fact that EA Green Bay LLC may have been bound under the terms of the franchise agreement does not suffice in and of itself to bind Ms. Everett, who never signed the franchise agreement. I think you can see a sharp contrast in terms of the sorts of benefits that suffice to bind a party under an agreement like this. If you look at the cases, American Bureau Shipping versus Tenkara Shipyard and Deloitte Nor Audit AS versus Deloitte Haskins and Sells. In the American Bureau of Shipping case, you had yacht owners who are, in effect, really third-party beneficiaries of a contract between the shipyard and the classification society, where the owners of the yacht were not parties.
Isn't that the point of the case, is those were third-party beneficiaries, therefore it wasn't direct benefit? Is that the...
It was a direct benefit. That was what the Second Circuit held in that case.
That's why I'm so confused. I can't tell the difference, but...
Well, I think the difference there is that you had yacht owners who were receiving themselves a direct benefit from the contract between the classification society and the shipyard. Here you have a contract where the franchise agreement between EA Green Bay, Matt Everett, and Paul Davis confers a benefit on EA Green Bay. Certainly Renee Everett benefits indirectly from that, but only by virtue of her status as an owner. It would be like if in the American Bureau Shipping case, the court had bound not the owners themselves of the yacht, but the owners of the entities that own the yacht to the franchise agreement. It simply ignored the corporate form in which the yacht owners were doing business and said the individuals behind this entity are somehow parties to this agreement. And while the court was willing to impose an obligation to arbitrate on the entities that had actually received the benefit, it wasn't piercing the corporate veil and going back to the owners of the owners. If you look at the Deloitte Nor Audit case, too, there you can see what a direct benefit is. Here you have a foreign corporation that...
Well, I can't. That's my problem. But go ahead.
The actual party to the case, the Deloitte Nor Audit AS, the party upon whom the obligation to arbitrate was sought to be imposed, was using the Deloitte name, among other things, under the agreement with the parent company, Deloitte Haskins and Sells. Here you don't have Renee Everett herself making use of any of Paul Davis' trademarks or anything like that. She simply has an ownership interest in an LLC that's doing those sorts of things. Whether the LLC...
Well, she ran a business for under that Paul Davis flag for 3 or 4 years, didn't she?
Well, it's important, of course, when you say that she ran the business, she held an ownership interest in the LLC.
Well,
that
she actually ran it for some time, I believe. I mean, she was the preeminent director of it.
She was an owner and a member of the LLC, certainly, Your Honor, but there was never a point at which she operated the business as a sole proprietorship, as distinct from a...
Well, you're talking legal gobbledygook, but I mean, in terms of who made the decisions as to what was going to happen, I think she was quite prominent, wasn't she?
She was important, although I would say probably less important than her husband during much of this time, but there was never a point at which the corporate form was disregarded, and the fact that the business was operating as an LLC was irrelevant to the way in which it was operating. Direct benefits estoppel is an equitable theory, and even if there were somehow grounds to potentially bind Renee Everett to arbitration under direct benefits estoppel, there were equitable offenses that Renee Everett asserted. One of those was laches. PDRI, in effect, presented this case as if it were tricked somehow by the Everetts over the years into thinking that Renee Everett didn't have an ownership interest, and evidence was presented, certainly, that the fact of Renee Everett's ownership was apparent for a number of years, that Renee Everett held herself out as an owner, and that Paul Davis certainly could not have been ignorant of this fact if it had cared to know the facts. It had ample opportunity to obtain a more formal contractual relationship with Renee Everett. It didn't do so. And under those circumstances, even if there might otherwise have been equitable grounds to apply the doctrine of direct benefits estoppel, We think here the defense of laches would preclude application of the benefit. We also think that the doctrine of unclean hands is relevant here. There was evidence in the record to the effect that contrary to representations that had made to Matt Everett, Paul Davis Restoration had offered a right of first refusal on this Northeast Wisconsin territory to another individual by the name of Dan Drummel before Mr. Everett even acquired his franchises, and that prior to the termination of all of Mr. Everett's franchises, that there were discussions between Mr. Drummel and Paul Davis Restoration regarding a takeover of these franchise areas by Mr. Drummel. Even if the court were not, were otherwise inclined to apply direct benefits estoppel, we think that those theories should give the court pause, either cause it to decline to do so, or at the very least remand the case to the district court for further investigation of those theories. Paul Davis also makes an alternate argument based on the doctrine of assumption, and there are three problems with that argument. The first is that the argument was never raised in its present form in front of the district court. The only assumption argument that Paul Davis made early on in the case was in the proceedings over the preliminary injunction. The argument there was that Renee Everett had participated allegedly as a claimant in a 2005 arbitration, and that having done so, that she was thereby bound to submit to further arbitration proceedings at a later date under the same franchise agreement. Now, there were a couple of problems with that argument. First of all, was that the inclusion of Renee Everett in the 2005 arbitration proceeding was only an error. Second is that Paul Davis had explicitly taken the position in those proceedings that Ms. Everett was not at that time an owner of the franchise. And the third is, of course, neither Ms. Everett nor anybody else obtained any relief under those proceedings, such as would be required for any doctrine of assumption or estoppel to apply. Second, though, even if that were not the case, Paul Davis persuaded the district court in its successful opposition to Renee Everett's motion for preliminary injunction to reject the factual premise underlying its assumption argument, which is that the factual premise being that Renee Everett was had obtained an interest in this franchise in 2008 as part of an explicit attempt to obtain rights under the franchise agreement. There was testimony to that effect in the record. Paul Davis argued quite vigorously that that testimony was dishonest and that, in fact, Renee Everett had held this interest in the franchise agreement since before the franchise agreement was even signed. The court considered that, and for better or for worse, it did decide that the argument that this 2008 transfer for the explicit purpose of getting Renee Everett rights in the franchise agreement was not something that had ever occurred. In fact, the ownership interest went back much further. The third problem with the assumption argument is that it misunderstands the doctrine of assumption to apply in much broader circumstances than it does apply in. In fact, the doctrine of assumption applies where a party by its words or its conduct manifests intent to submit to arbitration and then later tries to disavow the arbitration because it doesn't like the results. That isn't what Ms. Everett did here. In fact, she has consistently avowed an intent not to be bound by the franchise agreement and has done everything in her power to avoid any obligations under the franchise agreement. Finally, I'd like to touch just briefly on the idea that there is an obligation to arbitrate in the franchise agreement as a matter of first principle. The argument is premised on the idea that the franchise agreement does in fact contain this arbitration clause, but it ignores a separate addendum to the franchise agreement, which says that the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law applies and preempts anything to the contrary in the franchise agreement. Now, the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law has a provision stating that franchise contracts are arbitrable only under circumstances where the protections provided in the franchise agreement are equal to or greater than the protections allowed by the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law. Here we have a franchise agreement that doesn't allow for a number of those protections. Now, I know Paul Davis argues that the case law has, in effect, read that provision of the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law out of the law. That's because the cases consider that provision of the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law to be federally preempted. If we were in state court and if there were no Wisconsin addendum to this contract, that would certainly be an important doctrine to consider in the Supremacy Clause. But here the parties have explicitly agreed that the WFDL applies. And while, as a matter of law, absent a contractual provision to the contrary, courts are certainly obliged to apply federal preemption because of the supremacy clause. That doesn't mean parties aren't free to contract for the application of state law as opposed to federal law as a matter of contract rights. And here we would submit that they have done so.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Bellick?
Yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to read, and this is an appendix at 36 from the 6.3 operation under corporate structure. All shares of stock or other ownership interests of franchisees shall be held solely by principal owner, and any transfer shall be subject to the provision of Article 20, and all stock certificates shall include the legend, quote, the transfer of this stock is subject to the terms, conditions, and restrictions of a franchise agreement with Paul Davis Restoration, Inc., end quote. And to Your Honor's point, yes, Judge Griesbach did find abundant evidence at the preliminary injunction stage the direct benefits existed here, and it was only a little over a year later after we'd already arbitrated that I think he perhaps was struggling with the same issue of what's direct versus indirect, and we actually think he got it right the first time, candidly, and he should be reversed for all the reasons we've said. There's no waiver of assumption. I'll stand on our briefs, and the WFDL, the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law, is clearly arbitrable, those claims, as is well settled. Thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument next.